Well, good morning. This is Per Fargren, and I am doing the Friday morning talk show. And we'll be talking about Libya, which everybody seems to be talking about these days. And our guest is Pepe Escobar, who writes for the Asia Times, author of several books. I think his most recent book is Obama Does Globalistan. Pepe Escobar, welcome to KBOO once again. Oh, okay. Well, we're trying to get him. Okay. He has written, I think in about the last few days, he's written about four articles in the Asia Times, which is a website that I really recommend. There's a lot of interesting articles there. It's it's Asia Times, www.atimes.com. And they have all kinds of articles and a lot of good writers there. It's a good resource. So one thing is the latest they're talking about the end game in Libya, which seems to be turning endless. And the latest I heard is that they're still trying to track down Muammar Gaddafi. They don't know where he is, whether he's in his hometown of Sirte, which they're bombing, just in case, or whether he's holed up in some apartment building in Tripoli. I don't know. Anyway, Pepe Escobar, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're going to talk about Libya, which you've been writing a lot about, and I was saying that, not too long ago, the mainstream media has been talking about the end game, but the end game seems to be turning endless.
No, it's not end game. We are opening the gates of a huge quagmire in Northern Africa. There's absolutely no question about it. Look, I think the most important thing to talk about today is who's in charge of Tripoli. And I'm sure everybody in the U.S. will be absolutely shocked to hear that, okay, pay attention to this name, Abdel Hakim Belhaj. I'm sure very few people in the U.S. know about this guy. He's an Al-Qaeda man, and he's the actual military commander of Tripoli as we speak. This is the guy who conducted the offensive from the Western Mountains, where the Berbers are. It was the pincer movement.
Can you spell that name for us?
Abdel Hakim Belhaj.
How do you spell that last name?
Belhaj is B-E-L-H-A-J.
Okay, because I'm going to look
that. A little bit of background about this guy. He's one of, the Libyan arm of Al-Qaeda. He trained in Afghanistan. He was captured by the Americans. He was interrogated by the CIA in Bangkok. He was tortured. And then he was sent to the Libyans. He spent some time in jail, and then he was freed because he made a deal with Saif al-Islam, Gaddafi's son. Then he stayed in Libya in contact with the Salafi jihadist fringe in Libya. And then he migrated to the Western Mountains, and he was coordinating the offensive from the Berbers in the Western Mountains, south-west of Tripoli, for this past weekend. So this is the direct NATO, Cyrenaica, Eastern Libya, Al-Qaeda jihadi connection. And this guy is the actual military commander of Tripoli, as we speak, for the past 4 days at least. And this is completely crazy because in terms of what the mainstream media in the U.S. and in Europe has been spewing out, it devastates completely the narrative that these are pro-democracy protesters that then got a few Kalashnikovs and even a few tanks and marched to liberate Tripoli. It's completely crazy.
Well, speaking of weapons, one kind of disturbing thing was on the news the other day where when they broke into Gaddafi's compound, people came in and helped themselves to all kinds of weapons that hadn't even been unwrapped yet. And we don't know who those people are, where they took those weapons or what.
Exactly. And can you imagine once the dust settles and assuming the Transition National Council manages to impose some kind of order in Tripoli, or in Western Libya for that matter. They're trying to take over Sirte, where Gaddafi loyalists are still in charge. So we don't know. This could be a long drawn out battle as well. So assuming there will be some order, who is going to control these weapons? So we can safely assume that most of these weapons will end up in the hands of people like our Al-Qaeda men, or be thrown to Al-Qaeda's connections in south of Benghazi, in eastern Syria and Iraq as well. And if these people are not part of a transitional government or a new so-called stable government in Tripoli, they're going to start their own guerrilla war against the government in Tripoli. It's inevitable. That's why more and more it looks like Afghanistan 2.0.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's another name that hasn't been talked about lately, and it is Khalifa Haftar. Can you tell us anything about him?
No, this is not one of the military commanders. I was thinking about Khalifa Hitler, but this was the guy who lived in Vienna, near Langley.
Yeah,
that's a CIA asset. And then he came back to Libya two months ago. Is that the same guy?
Yeah, that's the one. I think his name is spelled differently. I've seen his name about two or three different versions, but that's the guy. Tell us about him.
Well, this is the guy who he actually defected from the Gaddafi regime 20 years ago, for that matter. And then he went to the U.S. He lived in Virginia for, almost 20 years. He is a CIA asset, according to our best information. He came back 4 months ago, and he proclaimed himself military commander. So he was in direct shock with Abdul Fattah Yunus, the military commander who was actually killed by the rebels 2 weeks ago. And you know who, according to our best information, once again, the people who killed Yunus, the rebels' military commander, were Al-Qaeda linked. That means linked to the guy who is now the military commander of Tripoli. So I know this proves that the incestuous relationship or opportunistic relationship between Gaddafi defectors, Al-Qaeda linked jihadists, and all that proves to all of us that you simply cannot trust the so-called Transitional National Council. And that's one of the reasons, in fact, why they don't name names. The only two names that we know are the leader and the prime minister, the guys who are actually talking to France, to Italy, to Britain. They talked to Berlusconi yesterday when they visited Berlusconi in Milan. The other ones are invisible. Why? Because they all have extremely shady past, usually linked either to Gaddafi regime's nasty acts, let's put it this way, or to the Salafi jihadist nebula, you know.
Well, the two leaders of the TNC, one is Mustafa Abdul Jalil, who is supposedly, an honorable guy for a judge. He was a judge under the Gaddafi regime. And you pointed out that he was the one who condemned the Bulgarian nurses.
Exactly. I was going to when you mentioned, I was thinking about that. This is the guy who actually the famous scandal in 2007 when a bunch of Bulgarian nurses were accused of being spies in Libya. He's the guy who condemned them. Later, he became justice minister, appointed by Gaddafi. But this was a famous case in 2007, especially in France, because Sarkozy, at the time, he said, no, I'm going there, I'm going to liberate the nurses. And he actually sent his former wife, Cecilia, to deal directly, to plead directly with Gaddafi, and it worked. Cecilia is very persuasive. I would say much more persuasive than Carla Bruni, which would probably sing a song to Gaddafi or something. But Cecilia actually arranged the release of the Bulgarian nurses. And after that, Jibril was named...
Wait, Jalil or Jibril?
By Gaddafi.
I see, we're talking about Jalil, right?
Jalil, I'm sorry.
I was going to get to Jibril later.
We're going to get to Jibril later, you bet.
So Jalil, he became the justice minister, and then somewhere along the way, he went over to the other side.
Exactly. So he was justice minister from 2007 to February this year. He defected in February this year because, he said on the record he disagreed with the way Gaddafi was suppressing the Benghazi protest movement, which started basically in February. But look, he was working with the regime all the time, so he knows the secrets of the regime very well. But we still don't know how reliable he is. Very important. He's a specialist in Sharia law as well. He studied Sharia law and civil law at the same time at the University of Libya. So this is, he could use his knowledge to sort of establish some kind of serious dialogue with the Islamic fundamentalists in the East. And even explain to them why they shouldn't have a big role in the next government. Or he could be a mole.
Okay.
He could put him right in the center of the next government as well. We don't. Nobody knows. Nobody knows.
Well, now let's get on to Mahmoud Jibril.
Well, Mahmoud Jibril, he studied at the University of Cairo. He studied at the University of Pittsburgh as well. He speaks English fluently. He has very good contacts in the West. So that's why he is touring the European capitals and speaking with Berlusconi. He's going to speak to Sarkozy next week in Paris. So he's I wouldn't say more acceptable, but the more westernized face of the next regime. So he is the prime interlocutor for all the NATO powers, for the Europeans, and for the Americans as well. And he's already saying more or less explicitly that in terms of business, because now there is the gold rush for Libya has already started, especially in Europe. The Americans are, I would say the Americans are on a wait-and-see attitude for the moment. But the French and the Italians are now involved in a commercial trade war to see who gets the juiciest contracts in Libya. And Jibril is talking to both sides. So they only talked business yesterday in Milan with Berlusconi. And Eni, the Italian oil energy giant, is already back to Libya in the next week or so. They're going to send fuel to Libya, and then they're going to be paid in oil later on when the oil fields in Libya go back to normal. At the moment, they're pumping up like 50,000 barrels of oil a day, which is nothing. Their production before the war was 1.6 million a day, but this is going to take a long time. But the Italians are in front in the business war, the French right behind, the Brits are going to start the next few days, and the Americans as well.
Well, one thing I wonder about is this, Europe is they are really struggling. Their economies are on the, seems to me, from what I hear, their economies are on the verge of collapse. Will this bonanza lift Europe out of all this? I mean, how much time does Europe have?
Wow. Look, in terms of big corporations, or like big Italian companies, there were, before the war, 180 Italian companies doing business in Libya. And the French, who were trying to close very juicy contracts with Gaddafi before the war as well, but Gaddafi was saying, no, maybe let's renegotiate again. That's one of the reasons why the French wanted to invade, especially in terms of oil, in terms of reconstruction, and in terms of water as well. This is very, very important. Nobody's talking about this, but because Libya has an enormous reservoir of fresh water that could last like 1,000 years or so.
Can it really last that long? I wonder about that.
Yes,
okay.
There's so much fresh water under the desert.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been harnessed by a famous project. Anybody can Google WikiLeaks and Wikipedia, and read about the great man-made project, which cost like at least $25 billion. And it's a network of pipelines from the desert spreading fresh water to the whole Mediterranean coast. And this was organized, conceptualized, paid for by the Libyan government without IMF, without World Bank and all that, and taught a lesson to a lot of developing countries that if you invest in your own infrastructure, it's the way to go,
mm-hmm.
and you have no debt. So what the big water companies, which happen to be all of them, the major ones in the world, they are all French, they would love to go to Libya and privatize this whole thing and start selling fresh water all over the world.
Oh, wow.
So this is very, very important as a commercial deal.
The Libyans paid.
I'm sure, as they have discussed it, we know that there is an agreement between the NATO powers and the Transitional National Council in terms of oil and gas, any new contracts, we are the number one priority.
Oh,
so
wow.
Screw the Brazilians, the Russians, the Indians, the Chinese, the BRIC countries especially. But in terms of water, I'm sure the Sarkozy got this from the Transitional Council from the beginning. Look, in terms of water, we rule.
Mm-hmm.
So we just need to expect what's going to happen in the next few months.
Well, this is a Friday Talk Radio, and my guest is Pepe Escobar, who has been writing a lot about Libya lately. And if people want to call in with a question or a comment, the number is 503-231-8187. Another thing that was mentioned was that you quoted, let's talk about Richard Haass, who was the head of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yes.
And he is calling for an international force, sort of. Basically, what he's saying is that the Libyans, I mean, they've done the fighting and dying, but they're not capable of handling their victory. And so now this international force has got to come in and kind of do it for them. Is that a good assessment?
Exactly. This is he wrote an op-ed for the Financial Times that circulated widely in Europe. I don't know if in the U.S. people had been paying attention to it. But he's basically calling for a stabilization force, which is occupation. We know what happens to stabilization forces, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They stay there for years. But for the moment, there is a plan. It was drafted by the Brits with the TNC. It was leaked to the Times of London. And this calls for a stabilization force, let's put it this way, but only Arab countries, basically Emirates, and basically coordinated by the United Arab Emirates, the UAE. And it's very interesting because that raises a very, very important question. Who's going to be part of the stabilization force? They were calling up to 15,000 soldiers.
Mm.
The thing is, 50,000 now, XE, they have a training camp inside the Emirates, set up by Eric Prince, the head of Blackwater XE. And they are training mercenaries from all over the world. They have excellent former Colombian Death Squad members. They have a Jordanian Mukhabarat. They have South Africa mercenaries. The best mercenaries you can find in the world. They're training people there for months now. So are these people going to be deployed to Libya? Or are the Emirates going to pay for an army of mercenaries, Libyan mercenaries, let's put it this way, from eastern Libya, to, let's say, occupy Tripoli? Either one of those options, I can tell you straight away, major, major disaster.
Oh, boy.
First of all, the people in Tripoli, who have been ruling the country for decades now, they view the people in eastern Libya, in the Cyrenaica region, as a bunch of country bumpkins, illiterate, backward, religiously inclined to be very hardcore fundamentalists and all that. So can you imagine this population being controlled and subdued by an eastern Libyan force? It's not going to happen.
All right. Well,
I would say that the prospects of an Arab stabilizing force are even better, in fact.
Hmm.
But obviously people will see right through it that they are being organized, controlled, corralled by a bunch of foreign mercenaries as well. And this is not going to play well with the people in the whole region of Tripoli.
Mm-hmm. Well, we
so
got
any way you look at it, the only possible scenario, feasible scenario, is a quagmire or an instant guerrilla war developing, you know, within the next few days or the first month, you know.
Well, we got some callers on the line. Let's take our first caller. Thomas is on the line. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Per. Good morning, Mr. Escobar.
Good morning.
I'm very much an admirer of your work. I really appreciate your insightful and thoughtful analysis.
Thank you.
On Asia Times, and I think it's a wonderful resource. But I have a couple of question comments. One generally has to do with the nature of NATO as it's changed. You know, it seems like ever since the 90s, at the end of the Cold War, NATO has been systematically redefined into away from its original chartered goal of being an alleged European mutual defense pact and into essentially an offensive expeditionary force which supports Western imperialist agendas. And it's amazing to me, I haven't heard much comment in the media, but thinking about going back to Yugoslavia, you see the same kind of parallels. You have this transitional national council that emerges out of thin air in the beginnings of these hostilities in Libya, and all of these unsavory figures would somehow manage to begin to form their own bank. And it goes back to the Kosovo Liberation Army in Yugoslavia, where we saw, which was entirely a creation of the Central Intelligence Agency, which at the time the DEA officially stated that the KLA were distributing, or the Kosovar Albanians were distributing something like 80% of the heroin that was being consumed in Europe, and you saw Mujahideen. So we see the same sort of things. We see this humanitarian pretext. We see stories about these crazy stories about Gaddafi distributing Viagra and rapes and mass graves, and it seems like there's a new standard formula with NATO. And so you see this thing where NATO, you know, you have NATO comes in and you have a humanitarian pretext. NATO comes in and beats up on everybody. You have the International Criminal Court in The Hague, which selectively prosecutes the boogeymen. You have the UN, which comes in and puts its imprimatur on everything. And then at the end of the day, the IMF and the World Bank come in and lock everyone into a debt cycle. And I just wish, what if you could question on the whether humanitarian intervention pretext is going to be large going forward, and also what you see the role of NATO in this is.
Look, your analysis is absolutely correct. That's exactly what's been going on since Yugoslavia in 1999. Going through Afghanistan, and now the first NATO war in Northern Africa, which happens to be the first Pentagon-African war in Northern Africa as well. So, very important. The NATO meeting late last year in Lisbon, they approved a roadmap of master plan, which basically solidifies NATO's role as a sort of, I call it, a global Robocop. And that's exactly what they are. They are the weaponized arm of the UN, and they have their own agenda apart from the UN as well, which is to intervene in any areas that are considered war on terror prone or countries who are not part of turbo capitalism of hardcore neoliberalism, which is the case of Libya, of course. And the NATO-AFRICOM agenda in the Mediterranean, Northern Africa, exactly the same. From NATO's point of view, is to turn, according to what was discussed in Lisbon at the summit last December, to turn the Mediterranean into a NATO lake. That is, you remember ancient Rome, they call it the Mare Nostrum, our sea. So the 21st century of Mare Nostrum, our sea, is going to be NATO lake. There were only three countries who were not either NATO members or allied with NATO. They have multiple partnerships with the really Orwellian names, you know, with every country you can imagine. But there are three that escaped this classification. One of them is Libya. Now the problem affects. The other two, guess what? One is Lebanon and the other one is Syria. That's why there's got to be something regarding Syria within the next few months, even if the Russians and the Chinese are against it. NATO will find a way to circumvent a United Nations vote at the Security Council, which they would surely lose, of course, to try in Syria. And Lebanon because of Hezbollah as well. So when this whole process is over, it's going to be, Northern Africa, the Southern Mediterranean, and the Eastern Mediterranean are going to be a NATO lake as well. And in terms of Afrikaans, which is basically Stuttgart, because nobody within the African Union wanted a Pentagon command set in African soil. What they want is a base to conduct all sorts of reconnaissance missions, surveillance, and try to control what's going on in Africa. So now they have the perfect opportunity, the perfect beachhead. So sooner or later, expect an AFRICOM, NATO, or only AFRICOM in main base in Northern Africa. And that's the plan, and it was discussed. And if you go to NATO's website, and if you read about the meeting in Lisbon late last year, it's all there. It's
Well, actually, according to Wesley Clark, who was NATO's, they call him the supreme being in Kosovo or whatever, he said that this was planned 10 years ago, that at that time I guess the neocons in Washington, the Washington warlords, are talking about taking over seven nations in 5 years. And Libya was one of them, and Syria and Lebanon were on the list, Iraq and Iran.
You never read about that in the Washington Post, New York Times, or by watching CNN or Fox News. But it's all over the Internet, on independent websites. This means, once again, that citizens all over the world, progressive world citizens who want to get real information about what's going on in the war on terror or the globalist expansion or imperialist mastermind plans, and your information on the net. It's easily available in many independent websites. And, nowadays, according to what Richard Haas was saying in his op-ed, the Financial Times, they don't even try to disguise it anymore. It's out in the open. So it's up to all of us, citizens of the world, to go against it and to disseminate information to people who are, too busy in front of the TV and not exercising their critical faculties, right?
I think so. Well, we got another caller on the line. Sean is on the line. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. Hey, listen, so you did start touching upon part of my question, and that was to expound more on the whole issue of AFRICOM. And also, just, I was always curious as to why the so-called war in Libya was taking so long, and of course is still not ended. But when you've got the three major imperial powers of the world, current of between the U.S. and the British and the French, and then the NATO was in there bombing, why in the hell it was taking so long, supposedly, to take Gaddafi out and make some change? So I was wondering if you could just kind of answer to that. But I wanted to also mention a book, if you're familiar with Robert Harvey, who used to be associate editor at The Economist and part of the government, the British government, and, of course, is a conservative. He wrote a book called Global Disorder. And in that book, I would recommend anybody to read, are some very chilling quotes in there from American neocons about the very process of, like, Perry, you were talking about, this has been in the process, say, for 10 years or so, of how they have planned all this over the decades, of course, as part of disaster capitalism, in being so proud of how far they have gotten in terms of spreading Western global capitalism across the globe. I just wanted to recommend that as a read to anybody who's never heard of that book. Anyway, so I was wondering if you could expound a little bit more specifically on AFRICOM and how that ties into Africa and Egypt and Tunisia and so forth. Thanks, and I'll take my comments off the air.
And also, why did it take so long to win this great victory?
That's an excellent question, in fact. AFRICOM was used only in the beginning of the war because the Obama administration didn't want to be involved, deeply involved. So AFRICOM, basically, they coordinated the launching of the Tomahawks for the first 72 hours. based, they were based, they had a ship on the Mediterranean in coordination with the Stuttgart headquarters and in coordination with the NATO Naples. And then AFRICOM transferred, because the U.S., the Obama administration, didn't want to be closely related with this offensive. Remember that Sarkozy monopolized everything in the beginning. French Mirages were the first to bomb Libya. And because this was, from the beginning, a French organized war, we need a little bit of background here. The plans for the war itself, which was basically a military coup, they started in October 2010. That was last year, when Gaddafi's chief of protocol, he defected from Tripoli and he went to Paris. He was approached by French intelligence, and they concocted a sort of military coup with their connections in Benghazi. The Americans and the Brits came later, around December, January 2011. So this was a very good opening for establishing AFRICOM. This, in fact, AFRICOM's first African war, but only in the beginning, because basically, in terms of Mediterranean, Southern Mediterranean, North Mediterranean, that's the NATO's agenda that's more important. The problem is, as anybody who has covered NATO or went to their cons, I had the displeasure of working over there for a while during the 90s. I had to cover NATO. It was during the 90s. And if you learn how they make their decision, how it works, and how they are totally dependent on the Pentagon, you know that they are ineffectual. You can see that on a, I would say, a weekly basis in Afghanistan. And you could see for the past 5 months in Libya as well. The game changer was when the Obama administration in early July decided to authorize the Pentagon to pass all the best satellite, imagery, surveillance, you name it, information they had directly to NATO commanders. Then they start making advances. Because if you leave it to them, you know, you have Canadians, Danish, Italians, they cannot even communicate among themselves. Can you imagine organizing an attack plan or a decent bombing plan for that matter? So this, in my view, this was the game changer. This past 7 weeks, and that's how the war turned. Remember that only let's say 2 weeks ago or 20 days ago, there was no master plan for NATO. Their only plan was to bomb Libya and try to kill Gaddafi. They were bombing Bab al-Azizia, the fortress in Tripoli, virtually on an everyday basis. And this is what the Libyans were have been telling us and many other media. So their plan A was to kill Gaddafi. I hope somebody would kill Gaddafi from the inner circle. And plan C finally said, look, there's only one option left. Let's try to take over Tripoli. And then they organized this landing of troops from Misrata to the Tripoli shores.
Mm-hmm.
It was well coordinated, because then it involved NATO, it involved all the special forces on the ground, the British SAS, French intelligence, and especially the Qatari special forces, which were on the ground. They speak Arabic, they were dealing directly with no communication problems with the rebels, and they had trained a lot of rebels in Qatar itself. According to what we know, at least 500 or 600 of them undertook extensive training for over 2 months in Qatar itself. So they were shipped back to Libya. So we got all these people together, ground intelligence, air support, and the connection with the guy that we were mentioning in the beginning of the interview, the Al-Qaeda guy who was linked with the Berbers from the Western Mountains, so they could organize a pincer movement and everybody get to Tripoli at the same time.
Wow.
So that's why it took so long.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it was not the original plan. In fact, the only plan that NATO had was to bomb Gaddafi's compound.
Mm-hmm. Let me throw another thing in here. I understand that Libya has 140 tons of gold. Now, I'm going to tie this with about a week ago, Hugo Chavez said that he was taking his 360 tons of gold out of, I think it was stored in London, and I'm not sure what bank he's going to put it into, maybe his own bank. And he's taking this gold out of European hands. And the problem is that what I understand is that there are 100 times as much paper gold, you know, a little piece of paper saying you own this gold, to one amount of real gold. In other words, I guess what Chavez is trying to do is start a kind of a gold run on the banks or something. And now that if the West could control Libya's gold, then that would sort of maybe stop this run on the gold treasury.
Exactly. And obviously, and there is a direct connection. There's no question about it. Okay, first of all, because whatever you think about Chavez, Chavez and Gaddafi were always very close inside OPEC, and in terms of being developing countries fighting in their own world, Western imperialism. The thing about gold is crazy. Yesterday, the former governor of Libya's central bank said that in terms of physical gold reserves, in Tripoli only, there is $10 billion worth of gold. So we can obviously assume that Gaddafi had access to this gold, and now he's trying to distribute some of this gold among Western tribes to buy support or to solidify support. And that's one reason why we could think that a guerrilla war is inevitable. First of all, because they're not going to be subdued by people from eastern Libya. And second, because they want to try to get back to power. And third, because they have the means to do so. They still have weapons and they have money.
Wow. Okay, this is Friday Talk Radio on KBOO, and our guest is Pepe Escobar, who writes for the Asia Times, and we are talking about Libya. Phone number to call is 503-231-8187. And coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, One Land, Many Voices, and hosts Will and Wael will speak with Jesse Hagopian of the African Heritage Delegation to Israel-Palestine. Also, a look at the new Israeli anti-boycott law and more. At 10, Air Cascadia is off today. And so we're going to go to Flashpoints with a report on life and death situation facing correspondent Mahdi Nazem Roya, who is in rebel-controlled hotel in Libya. So we're going to have a little more news from Libya. We've been Flashpoints has been airing his dispatches from Libya. Also, a report on a dam project in Ecuador that threatens the culture and lifestyle of the indigenous people there. And finally, a look at the recent East Coast earthquake and its impact on a major nuclear reactor in the Washington, D.C. area. At 11 on the Radio Zine, Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence speaks on a reverence for all life. So, and we want to thank Cable members for your support. If you are not a Cable member, it's easy to become one. Just go to kboo.fm and click on the tip jar. So all that is coming up after this show. And we have another caller on the line. You're on the air.
Morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, thanks for the show. I had a question years ago and still today. It hadn't been answered. So maybe you could connect the run on the bank possibility. Years ago, I heard the first reports about the changes in Russia, and that they were buying up or using all the gold they had and making coinage out of it. How did that affect this value of gold, Western gold, and supplies? So I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks.
Boy, I don't know. I mean, I don't know that much about the Russian gold. I guess one thing, when you cut it up into little coins, it makes it easier for people to store it and save it and spend it whenever they need to. But anyway, Pepe, what do you think about that?
Look, the thing is, the most important thing for the moment, if you have gold, you have to secure your stash.
Mm-hmm.
This is what, basically, this is what Chavez is trying to do, and this is what Gaddafi was trying to do, but some of it, of his gold, is spread out, maybe in Britain, certainly in Switzerland, and it was frozen. so he can recover. So what he had in Tripoli is essential. So obviously he didn't plan well ahead. Just like the Libyan Investment Authority, their sovereign fund, they invested in a lot of really, really crappy possibilities, especially in Europe. You know, banks that are going under. They even invested in Pearson, who controls the Financial Times, but the actions, the stocks of Pearson were going down. So this is the most important thing. Control what you have. And the Libya had or has so much gold that they were trying to, that's one of the reasons for the war as well, very important, to establish a unified African currency, the gold dinar.
Mm.
And the gold dinar would be based on Libyan extraordinary, we don't know how much the amount, gold reserves. What's in Libya and what was deposited in European vaults as well. And that's one of the reasons, because forget about IMF, forget about World Bank, forget about Western banking intervention, forget about the Bank of International Settlements in Switzerland. This would be guaranteed by African gold reserves, and it would be the basis for an African unified currency. Almost everybody in Africa said yes to this proposition, except South Africa, which was heavily pressured by the U.S., and obviously the Europeans, like Sarkozy. I remember Sarkozy saying a few months ago that this was a threat to mankind.
Wow.
So you get a drift, right?
Boy, downfall of civilization there.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, here's an interesting article. There's a little bit of levity here. It almost sounds like a joke, but apparently it is not. This comes from an Israeli TV channel. It's called Arut Sheva, which is the sort of the voice of the settlers in Israel. And the story is that there is a woman in Israel. Her name is Gita Boran, who says she's a distant cousin of Muammar Gaddafi. And she recalls playing with him as a child and that he was a good boy before he became a dictator. And she says that he was full of joy and mischief. I saw him on a few occasions when we were growing up. We played together when he visited our home with his Aunt Didi. I saw him before my family moved to Israel. He was 7 years old and I was 13. And so she says that Gaddafi's grandmother is my grandmother's sister, and his grandmother is my father's grandmother. And she was Jewish, became Muslim, and married the town sheikh, and then she had children. But according to Jewish law, because he comes from Jewish grandmother, that means that Gaddafi is Jewish. What do you think of that?
You cannot make this stuff up.
No, this was in, you can look it up, it's Arut Sheva, and this interview was, this woman was interviewed by a newspaper called Yisrael Hayom. So anyway, there it is. But anyway, let's get back to Libya. You know, it seems to me that well, like you were saying before, that some kind of guerrilla war is certain to break out very soon. And it's because one thing you say, the rebels are spread thin. And also that 2,000 tribes are still backing Gaddafi. And this is according to
not 2,000, but there are roughly 140 major tribes in Libya.
Well, I get this from an interview. Some a fellow named Michael Malouf, who is a former Pentagon official, said this.
Look, I'm sure he's wrong.
Oh, okay.
There are basically 140 major tribes, and there are clans and sub-clans within these tribes. But in terms of tribal society, that's roughly 140. The thing is, some very important tribes are already behind Gaddafi. Well, I'll name a few. One of them is the Warfala tribe. Warfala tribe is the biggest one in Tripoli. They can have, there are no definite numbers about it, but they can have as many as 2 million people out of 6 to 7 million members of the Warfala and all the Warfala subclans, right? Gaddafi's wife is from the Warfala tribe.
Mm-hmm.
So this means a direct allegiance. They simply cannot betray one of them. Another one, the Al-Magarha strike. It's a small one, but they're very good snipers, for instance. So their skills are required, and you are behind Gaddafi as well. Another one, the Obeidi tribe. The Obeidi tribe is the tribe of the former, you remember the former military commander of the rebels who was killed 3 weeks ago?
Mm-hmm.
He was from the Obeidi tribe. So this means that the Obeidi tribe, which is a huge one in the east, now is trying to hunt the guy who is the current military commander of Tripoli, the Al-Qaeda guy as well. So you see tribal conflict is everywhere. This is a tribal society. There's no civil society to speak of, as we understand it in the West, in Libya. For a number of reasons, because basically most of the original population is Bedouins from the desert, or Berbers as well, and because of 40 years of dictatorship. Whatever you think about Gaddafi, it was a hardcore Saddam Hussein-style dictatorship, which was the only way to control all these warring tribes, to buy their allegiance, and to buy some semblance of order. So this meant, among other things, the eradication of civil society, of political debate. So if you antagonize, basically it's a little bit like in the tribal areas in Afghanistan. So if you don't sit down warring tribes, if they don't sit down, they discuss over a nice dinner and all that, there are discussions, or if a member is killed by a rival tribal member, it's total war. And that's what's going to happen between tribes from the east who conducted this pro-democracy NATO rebel offensive and tribes from the west in Tripolitania, which are more urban, they are more educated, they usually, you know, they went to good universities like the University of Tripoli, and they see the Easterners as a bunch of barbarians as well. So it's practically inevitable that it's going to be a tribal conflagration. You know?
Well, there's all these forces for disintegration, and then when the West comes in and tries to take over this so-called revolution, it just seems to me as it's guaranteed to erupt, you know?
Yes, it's absolutely guaranteed. And, we can even imagine, like in the piece I wrote today for Asia Times, of course, we're trying to visualize possible scenarios. You can even visualize the possibility that NATO itself wanted this to be this way. Because then, if they have a so-called insurgency in Libya again to fight against, perfect. That's still the war on terror narrative. Now we're going to fight against the people, subversives or jihadists who want to subvert the new democratic order in Libya. That's a perfect explanation. You know, it's a one-size-fits-all explanation, and obviously will apply to Libya as well.
Mm-hmm.
So this means that NATO will be totally entrenched in Northern Africa for the foreseeable future.
Does the West have the resources to do this, to stay in Afghanistan?
Of course not. But the thing is, NATO, as a military organization, and obviously not a humanitarian organization, doesn't think in terms of the politicians in London, in Paris, or Berlin. And obviously not in terms of Western European public opinion.
Mm-hmm.
They are an independent organization in terms of we set our own rules and our own global agenda, just like the Pentagon is in the U.S. It's exactly the same thing.
Wow, delusions of grandeur. We have another caller on the line. Jack is on the line.
Yeah, sorry if I'm coming a little late to this, so mm-hmm. if I'm redundant here, just let me know. But from what I've been following, reports from Webster Tarpley or from Mr. Engdahl, you're probably familiar with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Pepe is, I'm sure. The battle for Tripoli is far from over, according to them, that in fact, the rebels may have been led into a trap. That in fact, they could never have made it from the sea to the city without the carpet bombing of NATO and strafing through thousands of civilians, blasting a path for them to come in. And then there they are; they're all declaring victory. Yet Gaddafi's son shows up at the Rixor Hotel and says, "Oh, let me take you on a tour of our front lines." takes the journalists around, shows them that they're still in control of the city, and that the rebels are actually being repulsed and taken down. And it sounds like a huge propaganda war that's coming out of NATO, and that the goal probably to be able to make a declaration of victory that will be recognized around the world, and then be invited in for a substantial force to be landed that will not then be viewed as an invasion, but then as an invitation to come in and
protect
oversee the post victory rebuilding of the country or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that?
Look, it's more or less what's happening. There's no question. Just like the TNC invited NATO to bomb their own country. In fact, not bomb the parts of the country where they live, in eastern Libya, in Cyrenaica, but to bomb western Libya, the Tripolitania region, and especially Tripoli. So, in terms of hypocrisy and in terms of being patriots, tell me about it. Now, so now, if they create these conditions, like NATO could declare victory this week or next week. The problem is you cannot declare a victory. You cannot do a mission accomplished 2.0 when Gaddafi is on the loose. And nobody knows what kind of support he enjoys among especially Western Libyan tribes. But it's true. The offensive was massive. The bombings were absolutely devastating. The best reports that we can gather from an array of sources. It's true. At least in the first few days, at least 2,000 people were killed in Tripoli and around Tripoli, plus 5,000 wounded. And if we take the past week, we can say that at least 5,000 people were killed.
Wow.
Most of them, the absolute majority, civilians. There were massacres on both sides. Now some of them already documented, and even the mainstream media is talking about it. Even Reuters is talking about it. But, okay, so it was a devastating, and they took over, we can say for sure, at least half of Tripoli. But Tripoli is a sprawling city of 2 million. So you can control it, just like in Iraq. I remember in Iraq, for the past few years, the last time I was there was during the surge. You had to go from one neighborhood to another, you had to pass checkpoints, and everything was walled in. So this could happen in Libya as well.
Mm-hmm.
So right next to the Rixos Hotel, which is in the hand of Gaddafi forces, the next neighborhood is controlled by the rebels. Totally normal.
Okay.
And obviously there is an offensive against Sirte today, as we speak.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Sirte is Gaddafi's original fiefdom, original city. Nobody knows if he's there or not. So the last I heard, like half an hour ago, that Paris is saying almost for sure that Gaddafi is in Sirte, according to French intelligence,
mm-hmm.
right?
Got a question.
Go ahead. Please go ahead.
Well, I got a question from a listener. Is Libya considered Arab or African?
Very, very good question, because from now on, it's going to be considered Arab. And in fact, the TNC now is part of the Arab League.
Mm.
Don't forget that the Arab League is basically controlled or dictated by Saudi Arabia, the House
uh-huh.
of Saud, which is one of the main backers of this war. And don't forget that the African Union was against the war from the beginning.
Uh-huh.
So this means now Libya is being considered by the Gulf monarchies, the Persian Gulf monarchies especially, as an Arab country. They would love, in fact, they are dying for Libya to become an emirate.
Hmm.
Like
sort
of Persian Gulf Emirates transported to Northern Africa, you know what I mean? Aligned with the U.S., aligned with Western
uh-huh.
interests.
And the king's nephew is back, coming back, he says. Let's see if we can squeeze one last caller in here.
Okay.
Bruce is on the line. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, I just wanted to ask your guest, great show, I got in late. How does your guest see Gaddafi? Is he in the mold of a Nasser or a Nkrumah? Is he the kind of Pan-African leader that could have been effective had he been left alone? Or what is his feelings about him stacking up against Nasser or Nkrumah?
Okay, good question.
Very good question, because let's say in the first 10 years of his reign, his model was Nasser, and he thought he was the new Nasser. So that was a so-called socialist republic, distribution of wealth, large investments in education, health services, free housing for the whole population. And that's why sub-Saharan Africans, where Libya for them was a paradise in Africa. I remember when I was, like 10 years ago, I was traveling in Central Africa, and I saw, you know, rows of trucks filled with people from Niger, Mali, you know, Congo. They would cross the whole desert from Niger to Libya. It's a 3,000-kilometer desert highway, you know, and not highway, in the middle of the dunes, in fact, with a few bottles of water, because they knew they, when they reached Libya, they'll find a job, free housing, free education. They could go to university, support their families in sub-Saharan Africa. So this was all thanks to Gaddafi. But, you know, after 40 years in power, everybody knows, power corrupts infinitely anybody.
Mm.
He became a caricature of himself. And he wanted to do deals with the West. And that's why he renounced his so-called weapons of mass destruction, his nuclear ambition. You know, he mended fences with the U.S. He mended fences with Italy, especially, which he said in the beginning would never happen because Italy was the colonizing power from 1911 to 1942. So this is, in the end, you know, he just wanted to do deals and live a comfortable old dictator life.
Kind of
so
lost it.
Because in the beginning, he was a real Nasser. And he was viewed as such by most Africans and even by a lot of people in the Arab world as well.
Well, I think we're going to have to end it there. We've been talking with Pepe Escobar, who writes for the Asia Times about Libya. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure, and I hope it was useful.
Oh, I think it was. Thank you. Thank you again.
Thank you.
And stay tuned for One Land, Many Voices.